We're live and we're local. This is a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, April 4th, 2018. I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. On today's show, we'll find out about the Sexual Assault Response Team and Sexual Assault Awareness Month. David Ramser will be here with a preview of the signings of his book, Melting the Ice Curtain. Bridget Lujan will be here to highlight Juno's Got Talent, and we'll hear about how you can adopt a flower downtown. Those interviews, National Native News, Bird Note, music, and more coming up right here on a Juno Afternoon. But first, a quick look at weather. Rest of today will be sunny with highs around 40, and tonight will be clear with lows in the mid-20s. Tomorrow, more of the same, sunny, highs around 40. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. John Graham, one of two defendants tried and convicted in the 1970s murder of Anna Mae Aquash on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, has lost another appeal. Graham raised issue with his 2007 extradition. Late last week, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the legality of the extradition process. Victoria Wicks has more.
In December 2010, John Graham was found guilty of felony murder based on the underlying felony of kidnapping, but was acquitted of first-degree murder. The federal government started prosecution because the crime occurred on the Pine Ridge Reservation, but Graham and the victim were both Canadian, and so the state took the case. In appeals, Graham questioned how his extradition remained legal when it was a nation-to-nation agreement, and the only crime listed was premeditated murder, not felony murder. Almost a year before Graham's trial, state officials received a document they said authorized the prosecution, but the trial judge agreed to seal it. Graham and his lawyer weren't allowed to see a copy until after the trial was over and the first appeal had been filed. Most of the process was upheld by courts in South Dakota, but one issue went on to the Eighth Circuit, that Graham's conviction violated the dual criminality provision of the U.S.-Canada extradition treaty. Graham's attorney Paul Wolf explains dual criminality in oral arguments in October.
After his extradition proceedings were completed, he was indicted for something that is not a crime in Canada.
But South Dakota Assistant Attorney General Paul Swedland responds that dual criminality is not an issue.
Frankly, even if it wasn't a crime in Canada, the Minister of Justice could still say, we're going to turn him over anyway.
Swedland says Graham should have taken the issue up in Canada. That sealed document came from the Canadian Minister of Justice and gave permission for Pennington County to try Graham for both premeditated and felony murder. Appellate judges held that whether the Minister of Justice had authority to issue that waiver is a matter of Canadian law. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
A federal court in Arizona has ruled the federal government must educate Native American children and address their mental health needs. From KJZZ Fronteras Desk, Laurel Morales reports attorneys say the decision sets a precedent for other tribes.
Havasupai students and the Native American Disability Law Center sued the Federal Bureau of Indian Education so it would provide adequate teachers, special education, and mental health services. The Havasupai Elementary School currently has three teachers to educate 70 students at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Havasupai Chairwoman Muriel Kutwaitua says the federal government has an obligation to Native communities.
Our children do not receive even minimal sufficient education. The consequences are dire for our children, for our community, and for our future.
The court's ruling recognizes for the first time in U.S. history that exposure to historic intergenerational trauma has an impact on the way kids learn. For National Native News, I'm Laurel Morales in Flagstaff.
Tribal leaders in Wisconsin joined Governor Scott Walker Tuesday as he signed bills into law. Among 64 bills signed, one makes changes to the handling of burial sites. Tribes have long fought for protection of burial mounds across the state. Another bill expands the use of tribal ID cards to include voter registration, voter ID, and alcohol and nicotine purchases. Ho-Chunk, Oneida, and Mole Lake leaders were among those at the state capitol. In a statement this week, National Indian Education Association President Dr. Jolene Bowman said Indian educators stand with teachers in Oklahoma who are currently on strike seeking pay raises and school resources. More than 100,000 students attend public schools in Oklahoma, and Bowman says when teachers do not have resources and support, Native students and all students suffer. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members fight against poverty while earning money for college and gaining skills, with rewarding service opportunities around the country and info at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista. Support by the American Indian Higher Education Consortium, gateway to tribal colleges created by and for American Indians, accredited and local, with certificate programs to master's degree programs. Info at AIHEC.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm your Wednesday host, Shelley Delaney, and my first guests are here to talk about SART, or the Sexual Assault Response Team. Welcome to the show, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you.
All right, I've got four people in the studio, so I think I better start off by asking you all to please introduce yourselves and state your affiliations, and we will start with Swarupa.
I'm Swarupa Toth, and I'm the Sexual Assault Response Manager at AWARE.
My name is Amy Page, and I'm an Assistant District Attorney with the Juno District Attorney's Office.
My name is Alicia Gillis. I'm a nurse. I work in the emergency room. I'm the coordinator for the SANES, or the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiners.
And I'm Sergeant Nick Zito with the Alaska State Troopers, based out of Juneau.
And all four of you are on the Sexual Assault Response Team. So what is that, and how do you all work together?
Well, we wanted to take the opportunity, now that it's April, which is Sexual Assault Response Awareness Month around the country and even around the world, to let people know what we do and sort of what's going on around the Juno and the outlying areas. So the SART team comes together once a month, and our job is to debrief our cases and work to improve our response. We want to improve victim comfort throughout the medical forensic examination and the legal process, and we want to improve the collection of forensic evidence and really have expert court testimony for successful prosecution of sexual assaults and the sexual abuse cases. We offer this service to prevent duplication of services through our collaboration and our cooperation. And we really want to provide an easy access to confidential advocacy for victims of violence.
In April being Sexual Assault Awareness Month, what does that mean for SART? Just getting out the word more so
right.
than
our theme is your voice has power. So we're in some of the schools. We have some programs going on. People can get on AWARE's website, awareak.org. Don't forget the AK or the org, and see what we're doing around the community and in the schools.
Great website. I always like to mention it's got that quick emergency exit feature on the website if for some reason you don't want to be observed looking at that website. Okay, so I know we're going to talk about a lot today. One of the things we're talking about is drug-facilitated sexual assault. So let's start with that. Why did you want to come here and talk about that today? What's going on with that around Juneau?
Well, every year for sexual, and again, my name's Amy Page, every year for Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we as a SART team try to focus on one issue that has become somewhat important to the community of Juneau over the preceding 12 months. And in this case, thanks to reports by the community and reports that have been made here on KTOO, the spotlight is really shining on drug-facilitated sexual assault. We feel like it's important that the community knows that there are provisions in the law that specifically prohibit an offender's using drugs to incapacitate a victim for purposes of sexually assaulting them. It's a very serious offense that we are increasingly aware of, as I noted before. And while a victim of sexual violence is never at fault for what occurred to them, there are steps that we can all take to prevent drug-facilitated sexual assault. So we as a team are focusing on this issue during Sexual Assault Awareness Month because younger folks might not be aware of the steps they can take to prevent this crime from occurring to themselves or others, or how to respond to it if it happens to them. As Alicia will explain here in a moment, there are particular issues that are presented by drug-facilitated sexual assault that make it especially important that people be aware of these types of assault and take immediate action to respond to them.
So, and this has happened around Juneau in recent months. Do you know where it's happening or how many incidents there have been?
I am not specifically aware of how many incidences there have been. I know that the reports have been coming from the downtown corridor, the area of the bars, And I believe my recollection is that there have been at least three individuals who have been who have reported that they suspected that they were victims of drug-facilitated sexual assault.
And we can talk some more about prevention, but if this happens, how should you go about reporting it, and what is the response like?
So really, timing is of the essence with this. My name and my name's Alicia. I'm the nurse from Bartlett Emergency. So unfortunately, there's a wide range of drugs that could be used. Anything over the counter, for instance, like Benadryl or diphenhydramine, cough syrup. There's some other illicit drugs that could also be used, and I can talk about those in just a moment. But the first issue is that some of them are through your system really, really quickly. They're tasteless, odorless. They're hard to detect in your drink or however else somebody might try to administer them to you. We're talking between 10 and 12 hours, sometimes up to 72 if we're talking about roofies or rohypnol or flunitrazepam. These are all the same name for the same drug. As far as who is using these and where they're being administered, I really don't have any good data on that, and that's part of the difficulty with this as well. A lot of times victims will wake up in the morning. We have to think about their clinical presentation, and what that means is how the person feels. If you are somebody who is a regular drinker and you go out and the next morning you wake up and you're very disoriented or you just don't feel right, you feel like you have had the worst hangover you've ever had in your entire life, something just doesn't feel right. You have periods of blackout that don't really fit with your regular drinking pattern. Your body doesn't feel right. You feel like your clothes are in a disarray. These are the kind of things that we really try to look out for as far as the medical community that when we're discussing with people about things to be concerned about. So unfortunately, sometimes if you have sort of a regular drinking pattern that maybe you overdo it or you have a blackout, and then unfortunately, victims a lot of times have a lot of shame about this kind of experience that may have happened, and so they may not present for a while. So really, one of our big goals right now is to make sure that people have awareness about the possibility of something like this occurring and presenting, coming to the emergency room, going to AWARE, reaching out to their friends and saying, you know, very quickly and say within 10 or 12 hours, you know, with the next day, if things just don't feel right, listen to your instincts.
Well said. And what can they expect if they come in to report something like that, either to Bartlett, to AWARE, to law enforcement?
Well, you stated several options that people could follow. So the route is a little bit different depending on how they reach out. If they go to AWARE, typically they would meet with an advocate. I'll let Swarupa talk a little bit more about that maybe in a minute. They could call 911 if they really needed to, if they felt like they were in a place where they were unsafe and they needed to get out of there right away. They could go directly to the emergency room and ask, go through our triage and say, you know, that they need help. They could. Is there anything else I'm missing as far as avenues?
Well, SART, I understand, mobilizes too. Could they contact SART directly, or does SART get called in by another person, another party?
Any one of those methods mobilizes our team.
Great.
At AWARE, a person can come to AWARE or call AWARE 24/7, anytime, night or day. We have advocates available, and there's always a special SART advocate available. That's part of what makes this theme, Your Voice Has Power, so important right now, because sometimes just calling and asking questions or talking about what happened, it can be so impossible to know what to do after a trauma. Alicia has expressed how you may be completely disoriented and may not have known what happened to you at all, much less that it was a sexual assault. So calling AWARE and talking to an advocate we would be sure to show you the first important emergency options, like if you did need to go to the ER for medical support. But we would also talk about the options of reporting to the police right now or law enforcement, the options of going to the ER for an exam right now. Is that exam going to be anonymous or not? There are windows of time, and pretty much if you can preserve your DNA for up to a week, 7 days, you don't have to go to the ER for the kit immediately. And sometimes that's the best answer. So coming to AWARE isn't a bad way to begin the process, because we can route you to, if you really want to get in touch with law enforcement or call out the team, we can do that right away or help to time it and tell you what to expect next.
And if someone does feel like they've been dosed with something but they don't believe an assault has occurred, they should still report it. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Part of what we do as a team is track these trends to try to identify where these reports are being made, which bars they're being made at, who's responsible for the bars at that period of time, and also just trying to track what the trends are over time. That's part of our responsibility as a team. So if you have a concern that somebody has put something in your drink, that you have been drugged, or but not that a sexual assault has occurred, you should still report that to law enforcement, and that would come back to our team. It's very valuable information.
This might be a good time to mention the Safe Bars Initiative, which I know that some of you have worked on, and they were here last week to talk on the show too. That's something that some of the bars downtown are participating in. Could you say just a little bit about that briefly?
Just briefly, Britt Tonneson is working on that. There's information on our website, awareak.org, about that. But we have trained trainers to train the people who work in restaurants and bars on the floor, their employees, to intervene. And the important thing to remember that safe bars is really safer bars. What is going to make it work is that each of us, each community member, comes together to intervene and to support one another and keep an eye on one another, because you can never tell who might be a perpetrator of this kind of violence or who might be a victim of it at any moment.
Yeah, I'd just like to add, if I could, look out for each other. If you see somebody and they don't look like they're safe, they look like they're way too drunk or they're way too intoxicated or impaired, regardless of whether or not you are worried that person is going to be assaulted, I mean, it's just better off to get them to a safe place, whether that be just making sure they get into a cab or they're with somebody that you know that they can trust. Just looking out for one another in the community.
Great. And I'm going to turn to you now. Can you introduce yourself again, please?
Yeah. Again, this is Nick Zito with the Alaska State Troopers.
What role does Alaska State Troopers play in prevention and response to sexual assault?
So in Southeast Alaska, specifically out of the Juneau area, the troopers based out of Juneau, we're primarily responsible for the rural communities in the northern half of Southeast Alaska. The Ketchikan Post services the southern half of Southeast Alaska. So our primary role is response and investigation in those rural communities when a report or even sometimes we get reports by rumor of a potential sexual assault or sexual abuse of a minor case that comes out of one of our rural communities. And then also part of that is several rural communities have their own local small police departments. And in those communities, oftentimes we're tasked with either helping them with that investigation or assuming that investigation, because oftentimes there's conflicts. It's a small community, and it causes potential conflicts in that community with those officers. So we'll either help them or help guide them through the process.
Great. And I understand, based on some background information, that education is a large component in prevention and reporting of sexual assault in small communities. And this question can go out to everybody. Does any of that education focus on teaching or counseling boys and men, those who might potentially become offenders?
Well, not just boys and men. It pertains to generally everybody that's in a school setting. We go in oftentimes a couple times a year to the various rural schools and the communities we service, and we talk to the children from teenagers to small children about inappropriate touching all the way to nowadays, especially with nude photos, sharing of that to try to curb some of that behavior so folks don't get in trouble. And also for prevention, to discuss about the like a lot of children, consume alcohol at times and to make sure that they're not taken advantage of or with the use of illicit drugs or substances to just provide education, make sure that children feel safe enough that they can report it to somebody that's an adult, responsible parent or responsible adult or even to law enforcement. And that's where, once again, AWARE comes in. We try to make sure that folks are aware of AWARE is a 1-800 number out in the rural community. So if they don't feel the need to call while we're there or for us to call, that they can call and use that avenue for assistance.
Now, AWARE also serves 9 rural communities or outlying communities in the northern southeast Alaska area. And our number is 1-800-478-1090. And AWARE offers programs for men that the prevention office puts on. There's for community members, a program for men called Men at Work. It's a fantastic program, and it's been around for just about a year. We also have in the schools Boys Run, and we also have the Juno Justice Coalition, which does a lot of great work with community members that includes men. So, you know, AWARE is gender inclusive, and I'm not sure that people are aware that. But we work with all people. And for sexual assault response, we always have been gender inclusive. So no matter how anyone identifies, we serve them.
Yeah, well, that's great. I'm really glad to hear that. I hope that those programs continue to develop. As women, we get a lot of education about how not to become a victim, but sometimes, I mean, we all know that it happens, and the victim shouldn't be blamed, as you said. And I'd like to see more programs like that that talk to boys and men about consent and respect, and also the lifelong trauma that an assault can cause. Well, thank you for being here today, all four of you. And I do want to mention that all four of you are on SART, but SART is much bigger than just the four of you. There are many people, many members. And are you accepting new members? Do you do training or anything like that if somebody wants to join the team?
Well, one member of our team that's missing that I think bears mentioning is Lieutenant Jeremy Weske of the Juneau Police Department. Obviously, JPD is the primary law enforcement response for assaults that are reported in the Juneau area proper. Lieutenant Weske is the representative from JPD on our team. So if anybody has questions of JPD as to how their response goes, they should feel free to contact him. He's very well informed and happy to assist the community in understanding JPD's role in these kinds of offenses. Otherwise, I think that Swarupa is the primary person responsible for volunteerism.
Yes, we have people who don't work for AWARE who are highly trained to respond to sexual assault and actually domestic violence emergencies in the hospital. We have a team of about 12 people now. It's really a beautiful team. And I know Alicia is developing her team of SANE nurses.
Yeah, absolutely. We have a kind of modified casual program that we've been working on in order to encourage community nurses. You do have to be a nurse, an RN, in order to become a SANE. However, I do look forward to meeting new community RNs that I haven't met before who may be looking forward to working with us.
Great. Is there anything that anybody would like to add before we wrap up this interview? It's a serious subject. There's lots of questions. I know we could go in depth on many of these topics that we've touched on, but since we are running out of time.
Well, I think it would be wonderful for people to really remember. I know we've seen it over the last couple of years, especially the last year with the hashtag MeToo movement. Your voice has power. It has power to heal. It has power of intervention. And it has the power to keep this happening to other people. So please feel free to call AWARE at 586-6623 if you have questions or you just want to talk for confidential services 24/7 in outlying areas, 1-800-478-1090.
Great. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Had me fooled. Told me that I was nothing without you. Oh, but after everything you've done, I can thank you for how strong I have become.
Cause you brought the flames and you put me through hell. I had to learn how to fight for myself. And we both know all the truth I could tell. I'll just say this is, I wish you farewell. I hope you're somewhere praying, praying. I hope your soul is changing, changing. I hope you find your peace, falling on your knees, praying. I'm proud of who I am. No more monsters, I can breathe again. And you said that I was done. Well, you were wrong, and now the best is yet to come. Cause I can make it on my own. I don't need you, I found a strength of
Youth have a target on their back. Tobacco companies have a history of marketing flavored tobacco products to attract kids. In recent years, there has been an explosion of sweet flavored tobacco products, like e-cigarettes and cigars, with flavors like gummy bears and cotton candy. Youth use may lead to nicotine addiction. Flavors can create the impression that a product is less harmful. Encourage youth to stand up to the tobacco industry by not buying into their deception. This message is brought to you by the Partnership for Tobacco-Free Southeast and Search.
Support comes from Northland Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and to prescribe solutions. Northland Audiology and Hearing Services, located in the Jordan Creek Center. Information at 789-6780. It is 29 minutes after the hour. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney, and here in the studio with me is David Ramger from the Institute of Visiting Scholar at the Institute of Social and Economic Research and University of Alaska Anchorage. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here again.
Yeah, we were just talking. You visited Juno several times to talk about your book, as it was developing and now that it's been published. And the title of your book is Melting the Ice Curtain, and we're going to talk all about that.
Okay,
but let's talk a little bit about you, first of all. How did you get into the position of writing this book?
Well, I'm a longtime Alaskan, been here for almost 40 years, spent about half of my time in Alaska in Juneau, working both in journalism for the Fairbanks News Miner, and then worked for two governors, Governor Cooper in the 80s and Governor Knowles in the 90s. And working for the governors, I spent a lot of time in Russia. This is when the Soviet Union was starting to open up. And so Alaskans were involved in a lot of activities in the Russian Far East, really starting in the mid-1980s. So I did my first trip to Russia with Governor Cooper in 1988, the so-called friendship flight, an Alaska Airlines flight, which we can discuss in a little more detail. And so I've been to Russia more than a dozen times, lived there for a while, and ended up writing this book, which is the first chronology of Alaska-Russia relations, contemporary relations.
What is the Ice Curtain? Why is it called that?
Well, everybody knows the Iron Curtain in Germany, and so this is a play on those words, an ice curtain. What happened was Alaska and Russian natives for centuries had free access across the Bering Strait and can visit each other. And at the height of the Cold War in 1948, the U.S. and Soviet governments decided that because of security reasons, that travel should be suspended. And so they built what we call an ice curtain. They basically prohibited any travel across the Bering Strait for 40 years. And the result was to isolate Alaska and Russian natives on either side of the Bering Strait for four decades, separating families, brothers and sisters, long-lost relatives who were reunited when things calmed down in the mid-1980s.
What was the friendship flight and what was its significance?
There were a whole series of efforts to try to improve relations and to end the Cold War. And in 1988, Alaska Airlines finally secured permission from both the U.S. and Soviet governments to fly the first commercial jet from Nome, Alaska, to Providenia, Russia, which is only 45 minutes across the Bering Strait. But the significance of the flight was it was filled with Alaska natives who had not seen long-lost relatives for 40 years. And so it was a very emotional reunion on the tarmac in this little tiny community of Providenia, USSR at the time. A number of Alaska dignitaries, reporters, politicians were on board as well, Governor Cooper, Senator Frank Murkowski, Governor Hickel. And it really opened the Bering Strait to about 30 years of very aggressive activity. Business, joint business ventures, civic exchanges, rotary clubs, you name it. Every group wanted to go to the Soviet Union and then shortly after that when the Soviet Union collapsed to Russia.
Mm-hmm. So it did improve relations. Did it? You feel as if it achieved its goal?
It did achieve its goal. For 30 years, basically, there was very good relations between Alaska and the Russian Far East. And in fact, we were ahead of the end of the Cold War in Germany. When the wall came down in Germany, that's generally considered the end of the Cold War. Well, Alaska was a year ahead of that in this friendship flight in 1988. And so we actually achieved a lot of progress. And Juneau played a key role in it.
How so?
Well, a number of Juneauites were pioneers in the area. A woman named Dixie Belcher, who's a musician here, took a group of 67 Alaska natives and other musicians across the Soviet Union in the early 80s. Dixie helped get permission for the friendship flight to land in Providenia. Former Mayor Bruce Botello was active. Just a long list of Juneau people, Joanne Grady, Steve Nelson, who helped establish sister city relations between Juneau and Vladivostok, Russia, which were actually quite active starting in the mid-1980s. They've sort of calmed down. But in fact, I just had a meeting this morning with the Juneau Sister City Committee, and they're trying to get relations going again, which I think is a great development.
I was going to ask about that. So you answered my question before I asked it. But I did want to know, what's the state of Alaska-Russia relations today?
There's not a lot going on between the two of us because at the national level, we're not talking. We're really kicking diplomats out of each other's country. Just last week, we closed the Russian consulate in Seattle, which is the consulate that most Alaskans went to if they had to get a visa to Russia.
I wasn't aware of that.
Russia reacted by closing the U.S. consulate in St. Petersburg, which is a pretty significant move. And so over the last couple of weeks, we've just kicked hundreds of diplomats from both countries out of each other's countries, which I think is a bad move. I think we need to keep talking. And steps like the Juneau Sister City Committee are taking to try to reestablish ties with Vladivostok. You know, it's low level. It's mostly cultural and civic exchanges, but it does keep the conversation going and broadens the understanding of each other.
So you receive funding and support from a number of organizations to do the research to write this book. Are you going to put out another edition? It seems like there's a few chapters that you could add at this point.
Yes, I turned in the final manuscript just as President Trump was getting elected, so I had to kind of speculate about his relationship with Russia. So there probably is another book to be written, but it's pretty hard to tell. It's hard to read Trump's relations because he's been very friendly to Putin. Just last week, he invited Putin to the White House, which is very different from what a lot of other countries, particularly in Europe, the stance that they're taking towards Russia. But I think, regardless of what goes on at the national and international level, it's good for local people to continue to talk. And it's difficult to do in Russia these days between Alaska and Russia because there's not much transportation. It's hard to get from one place to another. But there were a lot of friends established during the 80s and 90s that people are still in touch with, and they continue to talk.
You have a sense of the Native communities and whether or not there's a lot of movement, communication between those communities that sort of got reunited, that did get reunited with the friendship flight?
Well, one of the positive developments from the era that I discuss in the book was the approval of visa-free travel for natives of Alaska and Russia. So they don't have to go through the burden of getting a visa. But it still does not mean it's easy. There's very little air connections between Alaska and Russia these days. And it's also very expensive and pretty bureaucratic. I know there's a lot of natives who would like to see relatives on the Russian side, and there are occasional exchanges that are supported by the National Park Service and other groups, but there's not the level of activity that there was in the 80s and 90s.
Well, one of the reasons you're here today is to promote talks and book signings that you're giving while you're here in town. What are the details of those?
Well, I came in today and I spoke to one of the Valley Rotaries today, and I'll be speaking to the Juneau Bar Association Friday at the Baranoff. And then Hearthside Books does First Friday events, and so I'm their guest author this week at 4:30 at Hearthside. So I'll be signing books and talking to anybody who wants to talk about Russia-Alaska relations.
The downtown location, is
correct.
That correct?
Downtown.
Well, you're the expert in the field, so I'm certain that many people will be very interested to hear what you have to say. May I see the cover of the book, please?
Yes, you may.
That's great. Heard a lot about it, but I hadn't actually seen a copy
okay.
of it.
Oh, well, you can go to Hearthside on Friday.
Well, I might have to do that. All right, David. I wanted to ask what you'll be covering in some of these talks that you're giving. Are they formal, or are they just sort of going along with the book signings?
I do a PowerPoint as part of the book. There are 50 photos in the book from the era, so I use a lot of the images in my PowerPoint presentation and show pictures of the era. So there are a lot of pictures of Juneau folks, for example, in the book because of the work they did with Vladivostok and other parts of Russia.
Where can we find out more information about you and your work?
I have a website, which is www.davidramser.com. The University of Alaska published the book, and so their website also carries information about it. And it's available at all the standard outlets, bookstores, Amazon. But definitely encourage people to go to Hearthside on Friday.
Absolutely. So that's Hearthside Books this first Friday, April 6th, 4:30 to 7 p.m.?
Correct.
David, thanks for being on the show today. Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, thanks so much for having me. I always like coming back to my old hometown of Juneau.
Yes, welcome back, and thanks for being here.
Rock-a-bye, my baby. Hi, this is Erin Heist, board member of the Alaska Folk Festival, inviting you to the 44th Annual Folk Fest, which will stage hundreds of musicians from around the state and beyond starting April 9th. Our guest artists are Jason and Ferris Romero with Josh Raby, renowned for their haunting duets and handmade banjos. Concerts at Centennial Hall begin at 7 p.m. on Monday, April 9th, and run all the way through Sunday night. Go to akfolkfest.org for the schedule of performances, workshops, and dances. And as always, attendance to everything is free.
Join me, Troy Quinn, and the Juno Symphony as we seek to soothe the soul with a program of divine and inspiring music on Saturday, April 7th and Sunday, April 8th at JDHS. Vaughn Williams' familiar English folk song suite sets the mood as we travel across Europe to a work inspired by the majestic Swiss Alps. The full orchestra and the Juno Symphony Chorus, along with the Juno Douglas High School Choir, are assembled to play Fauré's life-affirming masterpiece, Requiem, featuring world-renowned soloists Anita Robles and Jarrell Williams. Tickets are at Hearthside, The Jack, JunoSymphony.org, and at the door.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon. It's about 19 minutes to the top of the hour. I'm Shelley Delaney, and my next guest is here from Juno Dance Theater to tell us all about Juno's Got Talent. Welcome, Bridget Lujan.
Hi, Shelley. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. For starters, tell us a little bit about Juno Dance Theater.
Juno Dance Theater, you know, one of those local nonprofit arts organizations that we love so much. It's been around since 1975, and we teach primarily ballet instruction. High quality ballet is our focus, but we also teach tap and modern, and we have fun cardio hip hop classes for adults and Pilates and all kinds of stuff. But we're running, you know, 7 days a week. We've got something going on in the studio.
Where are you located?
We're 8420 Airport Boulevard in the Alaska Litho Building, so we're right upstairs from them.
Cool. What are the format of some of the classes? Like, maybe not the ballet. Well, the ballet classes, too. Do they do, like, a multi-week run, or are they going on all the time?
We follow the school schedule, the school calendar. So we have a fall semester that starts late August and runs through, the Nutcracker. Our fall semester kind of culminates with the Nutcracker, and then we wind up right before winter break. And then we start up again in January and run through the end of May with a spring performance kind of in the middle. This year, that's at the end of April. The semester will run till the end of May. And then we've got fine arts camp in June and a summer ballet intensive in July and August. So we like I said, we kind of run 12 months of the year, but for the most part, our classes follow the school calendar.
And someone who's coming in for the classes more from like a fitness standpoint, like hip-hop cardio or the Pilates classes, do those follow the same schedule?
They do as far as the semester, you know, what our stop and start times for when classes are available. But the adult classes, the Pilates, the cardio hip hop, those all have a drop-in availability and a punch card for adults who just might, maybe they can't commit to a whole semester, but they just want to, you know, come when they can. Some of those are in the evening. Pilates is on the weekend. So they can mix and match those adult classes without having to really commit to a whole semester of a particular discipline.
Are you yourself a dancer, Bridget?
I that would be an overstatement. My background was more in theater, and I could dance my way out of a paper bag once upon a time if I had to. But no, we don't do that, no.
All right. Now, I've heard of America's Got Talent. This sounds like it's even bigger than that. So tell the good people all about Juno's Got Talent.
Yes, Juno's Got Talent. We totally stole the idea from America's Got Talent. It's just such a fun idea to round up all our talented local folks. And oh my gosh, the variety of talent that we see rolling in the door for auditions is just... It's really jaw-dropping. We've got all kinds of dancers from a tiny – we have a 6-year-old tap dancer to the Daughters of the New Moon, who everybody – most Juno folks are familiar with the belly dancers. And we've got some powerhouse vocalists. And so these are all local folks. We've got professional musicians
in here.
So
it's more than just dancing.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is a true talent.
This is not Juno think you can dance.
Right, right. Yeah, no, this was an all call for talent. I'm waiting waiting to see, you know, when the jugglers are going to show up and the flame, the sword swallowers and the flamethrowers. But thus far, we haven't seen that yet. But I'm hoping. But we've got a rap artist and a stand-up comic and a slam poet and assorted dancers and singers in there this year. It's going to be a great show. And like I said, anybody can try out, so you never know what your talent might be. Shelley, maybe you want to consider next year's auditions for yourself.
Sure, we can do Juno Afternoon, live from Juno's Got Talent.
Yeah.
All right, so when and where is the show?
Okay, 7 p.m. at the Jack this Saturday, April 7th. Tickets are $25 if you hurry up and get them in advance. There's only a couple days left for that. If you wait and buy them at the door, they're $30. So save yourself $5, get them in advance, and if you do get your tickets in advance, they'll come with audience votes. This is kind of a fun, unique feature of our show. We combine we have a panel of judges. There's 8 local notable personalities. We've got politicians and school superintendents and past winners of Juno's Got Talent and performers. Just a fun panel of judges. But then the 9th judge is the audience, and the audience votes with their dollars. So the judges will tally up their scores, and then the audience votes for each act, and those dollars get added on to the judge's score for this big cumulative score. The audience votes, they're $1 each. It's just, you know, you can throw in money or you can buy these vote tickets that we sell around. It makes it a little bit easier and convenient that way. If you want to spend $20, you can spend $20 and vote two for this person, two for that, and five
right,
for, yeah. So,
right.
But if you buy your tickets in advance, you get 2 free votes put toward your favorite act.
That's
so
a nice perk.
Lots of incentive to get your tickets early, which it's kind of not early anymore.
It's coming up, yeah. And where can we get tickets?
They are online at junodance.org or at the Jack at Hearthside Books. And like I said, you can take your chances and wait and buy them at the door, but you're going to pay more and you won't get your free votes.
All right, so get them early, get them online. And where can we get more information about the performance?
Also on our the Juno Dance Theater's website, it's junodance.org. Give a little plug for our MCs, our Erica Lee and Salisa Thole. They're such talented ladies, and they are going to also be performing along with Jocelyn Miles in their new group, Brown Sugar. So,
wow,
extra entertainment on top of the competition. The audience is in for a real treat with those talented folks.
Sure, yeah, and good thing they're not competing.
But yeah, the list of acts and the list of our judging panel, it's all available at junodance.org. Look under the events tab for Juno's Got Talent.
Great. Anything else to add, Bridget?
Oh, you can find us on Facebook and Instagram, Juno Dance Theater, Juno's Got Talent. There's a couple pages out there for the event. And like I said, 7 p.m. at the Jack. Doors open at 6. We'll have a bar on site if you're of age and you like to partake. We're going for a nice little grown-up event. We'll have concessions for sale and a balloon pop raffle, which is, again, a unique feature to this event. We sell balloons, $20 a piece, and there's only 50, and 25 of them will have prizes inside, or a little slip of paper that says what prize they won. So really good odds of winning a prize if you buy a balloon in our balloon pop raffle.
That is so cute.
It is fun. It's cute. It's a fundraiser, so we're looking for funds, looking how to raise funds.
And the proceeds go to Juno Dance Theater?
Yeah. Yep, and awesome. Lots of worthy programs there. Again, you know, we've got our fine arts camp that we put on every June, and we bring in, you know, high quality instructors and choreographers, and we offer lots of financial aid and scholarships to based on need. We try to make sure dance is accessible to everyone. It shouldn't be an elite art. We really want to see everyone dancing. So these funds help support our scholarship program as well.
Wonderful. Well, that all sounds great. I think you're ramping up to an awesome production this weekend. And thanks so much for being here and telling us all about it.
Thank you, Shelley. We'll be right back.
Sometimes friends are mean. Present company, expected present company. Just laugh it off. It's better than it seems. Present company, excluded in every way. Present company makes me want to stay. Go.
You're tuned into a Juno Afternoon, about 9 minutes to the top of the hour, and my final guest today is representing the city and borough of Juno, Carrie Cummings, here to tell us about the Adopt a Flower program. How lovely.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what you do for the city and borough of Juno, for starters.
Well, for the city and borough of Juno, I work for the landscape program, and we take care of all the parks. We take care of all the flowers you guys see downtown. We have about 13,000 plants that we plant and take care of and raise every year.
Wow.
So it's pretty cool. And we do all the mowing in the parks. We take care of Evergreen Cemetery. So we kind of do a little bit of everything just to try and keep Juno beautiful.
And does that include the flowers that are going to be planted this summer?
Yes, ma'am.
These 13,000 plants?
Yes, it does.
All right. Now, not too many people down south realize how well flowers can do up here in Alaska,
right.
Whether they're wild or they're contained, but and it doesn't look like it now, but of course it'll soon be a riot of color all over the place.
Yeah.
From downtown all the way out to the airport, from what I understand.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're here to tell us how they get here.
They get here. Well, we actually sow them in the greenhouse, but we also have an Adopt a Flower program, which we ask help from the community to help sponsor some of the beautification projects in Juno. We have It's been going on since about 2006, and we have about 15 to 20 donors each year. We're really hoping to try and up that number because, you know, as the economy goes on, the budgets get cut. So it's really nice to have extra help.
And how many folks do you have that plant and care for all these flowers?
We actually have 11 on the crew. We have, like, our crew split up. We have about 11 people that work for about 6 months of the year. Some a little less, some a little more.
And the Adopt a Flower program is how we, residents of Juno, can support this flower power. So
exactly.
Tell me how that works.
Well, you can contact us. You can contact us through our phone number, which is 364-2828, and you can talk to Ben Patterson. But basically, we ask for donations. It's kind of like, you know, when you donate to public radio, there's certain levels. There's a seedling level, which is $1 to $99. There's a flower barrel sponsor, which are the barrels that you see downtown in the parking lots, $100 to $199. The hanging basket sponsor, which you guys see everywhere, $200 to $299. And then flower bed sponsors, which is what we have throughout the entire community, is $300 plus. And you can – I have a mailing address. But if you contact Ben Patterson, he would definitely be able to help you out. But you can also mail checks to CBJ Parks and Recreation, Attention Adopt a Flower Program, at 155 South Seward Street in Juno, 99801.
People still do mail and checks and stuff.
Right? Every once in a while.
Now, does every flower get a little name tag with the person who sponsors it?
They do. Not the flower itself.
I know. I'm kidding.
I know, right? Wouldn't that be awesome, though? But we do have a big sign that goes up downtown right there by Marine Park parking garage that has the name of the sponsors for the year, businesses and folk and, you know, public folks, normal folks, whatever. And that goes up as soon as the flowers go out, and it stays up for, you know, most of the summer, so everybody gets to see it.
Well, how long have you been planting flowers, Carrie?
I think this is my 10th year.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just awesome.
You like the work?
I love it.
Do you have a favorite flower?
I don't.
You just love them all.
All of them, they're just so gorgeous. And it's really hard to pick a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think I have a favorite each year, you know, and then we get something new or something just does really spectacularly, and it becomes my new favorite. So,
is there something new coming this year that we should look out for?
A few new things. We try new stuff every year because it's kind of easy to grow stuff here, but you also have to be aware of the weather and stuff. So we try to just mix and match. There's not really, I don't know, anything spectacular, just different varieties of flowers. So,
is there anything that does particularly well here in Alaska?
We've noticed like a lot of our normal stuff is like salvia does really well. Pansies always do well, I think, anywhere. We have Rudbeckia, which are like the big sunflower-looking ones.
Oh, yeah. Those nasturtiums go crazy.
Nasturtiums do great here.
And the poppies, which I've never seen before until I moved here.
Yep. And we actually have some African poppies in some of our beds that do really well. I mean, we just have so many flowers, sometimes it's hard to keep track, you know?
I know. I think some of my favorites actually come towards the end of the season when you put in all those purple cabbages.
Yes.
I think
those
are
great?
So cool.
Yeah.
And I'm up and down Main Street all the time, and that's where I usually see them.
Yeah, that's one of our favorite places. And we like those, too, because they live through anything, and we get to keep them out a little bit longer in the fall. So, it just kind of adds a little bit of color in the fall when it starts getting gray.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Carrie.
Thanks
I'm really looking forward to flower season and summer. Any day now.
Right? Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for coming and talking about the Adopt-A-Flower program through CBJ.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in today to a Juno Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, Andy Klein... That's Friday's show. Anyway, our guests today, we had Bridget Lujan from Juno's Got Talent. We had Carrie Cummings talking about the CBJ Adopt-A-Flower program. We heard from the Sexual Assault Response Team about Sexual Assault Awareness Month. And David Ramger was here with his... talking about the signings he's hosting this weekend for the Melting the Ice Curtain. Catch him at First Friday at Hearthside Books downtown. Jeff Brown is the producer, and I'm your host, Shelley Delaney. Today's show will be available on demand online at ktoo.org. Until tomorrow, this has been a Juno Afternoon. Have a great Juno evening.